Week 15 in the NFL was a cold one in more ways than one. Brock Osweiler benched and Gus Bradley fired in Houston. Tom Brady breaks a long losing streak in Denver. Dallas gets right back on track. We'll have that and everything else from Sunday's action on the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit. We have just witnessed week 15. It was a really cold week, Andy.
It was a cold week, and there were a number of significant playoff games, and the least of games I saw went down to the wire, and a lot of games I didn't see, too. This may have been, I think week 10 was the really good week a few weeks ago, the great week where football felt like football again. This may have surpassed it.
Ooh, I don't know. That's a pretty hot take.
There you go. Yeah.
I think I'm going to disagree with you on that, and maybe we'll have a 45-minute debate about whether week 15 was better than week 10.
It's a good topic to have to debate. There were at least six or seven games that had playoff implications, and the score was decided by 3, 4, 5, 6 points, something like that, or less. It was a great week of football. It was tremendous, and we get another one next week. Next week has a ton of playoff implication games as well.
Yes, good finishes, big finishes today. And we're actually going to start with, sad finishes in topic one here.
Number one.
The Texans and the Jaguars came into this game. The Texans had a starting quarterback, and the Jaguars had a head coach, and neither guy had their job by the end of the afternoon. And right around the holiday season, it's a bummer. But yeah, we talked about on the first look ahead show, we talked about, and we'll start with Brock Osweiler, we talked about whether it was time to sit Osweiler and go with Tom Savage.
And I didn't feel at the time that it was time for that. But since then, Osweiler, if anything, has gotten worse. And it's not just that he's gotten worse, Gary. It's one thing to throw interceptions, which he had a few in this game today against the Jaguars. And it's one thing to do that. It's the way these mistakes are being made. And when you watch the film on him, he looks very robotic. He looks like scared is the wrong word, but scared is too harsh of a word, but let's, for a lack of a better one, so people know what we're talking about. He's playing a little bit scared. He's making the read, and he's making the read that the play design calls for and absolutely only that read and nothing else. There's no flexibility to his game. There's no nuance. It's very rigid, and because of that, he plays so mentally rigid. He's so uncomfortable that he's starting to play slower, and he's becoming very easy to defend. And when you get like that and you play that way long enough, then teams can start game planning specific ways to beat you, and that's where the interceptions really start to pile up.
Yeah, I mean, he looks completely unsure of where his receivers are going to be. And, I mean, it's sort of the basic tenet of throwing an object at another object is you want to make sure what you're throwing at. You want to be sure that it's going to be there. That was a terrible explanation of it, but you kind of know what I'm saying.
I like the explanation.
If you have no confidence in where you're throwing the ball to and that it's going to be open and that your receiver is going to be in that spot, it is impossible to refine ball placement and basically play quarterback at an NFL level. And that's what you saw today on both of the interceptions, really. And he got sat after back-to-back interceptions, obviously not on back-to-back plays because the Jaguars got the ball after they intercepted it. But that's how it went down.
Well, and you said that the word confidence, and when a quarterback loses his confidence, the other thing you start to see is he'll break himself down in the pocket. He'll start to perceive pressure that's not there. It's a whole – the Blaine Gabbert, this is what ruined his career, is you're not confident in the pocket, and so you anticipate pressure because what's going to happen to me next? And you wind up creating the pressure because you break yourself down in the anticipation of it. And we've seen that start to happen from Osweiler as well. So you cannot have that in any offense, but especially in a timing-based, gray area, multi-option offense like Houston runs. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, Gary, is that Osweiler, and this is not to make an excuse for him. I think at this point you do have to bench him. He hasn't played well. He doesn't have ideal receivers for his skill set or for the system they're running. He is not a tight window type thrower. He can be, but we're talking about a guy who's innately kind of cautious, and then you're asking him to play with a DeAndre Hopkins, a guy who asks you to throw through tight windows because he doesn't separate. He makes contested catches. Or you're asking him to throw to a rookie wide receiver in Will Fuller, who's going through some of the natural ups and downs that rookies go through, or to a Braxton Miller, who really isn't, he hasn't played the position for very many years, and he's learning on the fly when he was healthy. So he hasn't had the right type of receivers either. It's not like he has a Brandon Stokely type slot veteran guy or something who can stabilize the offense. I don't know why I came up with Brandon Stokely. It's not 10 years ago, but you know what I'm saying.
The greatest wide receiver of all time, I believe.
He doesn't have one of those just solid veteran stabilizers.
Yeah.
It's a tough ask for him, but now they're going to ask the same thing out of Tom Savage, and I'll be eager to see how he looks moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, Savage, you know, he got the job done today. It was an ugly win. They did it field goal by field goal, and then finally they got the Lamar Miller touchdown at the end of it to take the lead and get the win. Savage, I mean, he clearly had a better rapport with DeAndre Hopkins, and I think that's been the biggest frustration for basically anyone who has watched Houston Texans football this year, is he just... Everyone was sort of pulling their hair out, and we've talked about how Hopkins is a bit of a flawed receiver, and people might not realize that, but you know, he's not a guy who should have 600 yards every season. He's better than that, and that's the kind of year he was having with Osweiler.
Hopkins needs a quarterback who's going to turn it loose, and Osweiler right now is pretty much the opposite of that. He's not a confident quarterback.
Well, if we can go to the other sad story in this one. And by the way, it was kind of a... It was a little bit off-putting, the like how the crowd went wild when Osweiler came out and Savage came in. And I know you could say you're rooting for Savage as much as you're rooting for Osweiler. I have no love for Brock Osweiler. I thought he was a little bit... there were hints of turdishness when he was sort of playing himself up as some sort of victim that the Broncos wouldn't pay up for him or didn't call him or whatever his beef was. During free agency, but it was harsh
to have him be cheered when he got pulled.
Yeah,
well, at least we've seen other QBs who've been removed because of injury, and the crowd has cheered that.
Yeah.
So that's the bar if we're talking about harsh crowd behavior. I think that comes with the job. How many millions did he sign up for again?
He's going to be getting about 36 over the next 2 years,
something like that. I think that can cover the negative part of, hey, the crowd sometimes is going to like it when you get replaced.
Well, it's also going to be interesting, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but they can get out of that contract after next season, and after next season is when Savage's rookie deal runs out, so they'll have a couple of decisions to make here. But
so
the
stay
other
tuned
side,
this offseason. Stay tuned for Houston Texan offseason talk for probably 7 months this year.
There you go. We'll do like a 3-hour special on it. It'll be great. The other side of the sad story down in Houston, Gus Bradley did not make it through the day. And we all kind of knew this was coming, but you know, this was a game that they, I don't know what else you can say. They should have won it. I mean, this was one of the times where they didn't fall behind by 28 points at halftime and have to come back, and it was kind of like just watching them try to hang on, and they got a 100-yard kick return to stretch the lead at one point, and it was still not enough. It's never enough.
Well, I've heard that they made the decision because they wanted to begin their coaching search, and you get the early jump on it now if you're Jacksonville.
Yep.
You also, out of courtesy to Gus Bradley, and I don't know what the rules are for talking to teams, but Gus Bradley knows people around the NFL, and you don't have to talk to him formally, but he can start searching for his next job as well. He doesn't have to go to the Senior Bowl in Mobile and be handing out business cards, hopefully. So it's the best, given the situation, it's the best outcome for everyone. But if that's true, that they decided to let him begin his search and they begin their search, that sort of implies that they hadn't decided whether to fire him before this game or not. And I find that a little hard to believe. I think would imagine the writing was on the wall in the office of Shad Khan several weeks ago, which in that case, if they fire him today, then part of me wonders if it's a little bit reactionary that you're upset about the loss, that it is scratching an itch for the owner there. I don't know. It probably doesn't matter a whole lot because it's the right thing to do to fire him. It wasn't working out. He didn't get the job done. He's a great coach, great guy, but didn't get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
But the timing's always, that's a little precarious when a coach gets fired on the same day, just hours after a heartbreak loss.
I asked you this a couple weeks ago, but I'll ask again. If you're coming in, is Blake Bortles, is he out? Is he in as your starting quarterback, or is he in as a guy who you're going to have compete for the job?
I try to find someone who can rework Blake Bortles. I overlook this season, or I bank on what he's done the first few years. I take a chance with that. I'm not sure I'm super confident in it, but I don't think there's a better alternative. You're not going to just find a more talented young QB falling out of the sky and onto your roster. And so I find someone that can work with Bortles, because the rest of that roster on offense built around him, it pretty much fits his style of play. Those big perimeter wide receivers, that's what you need when you have a slower wind-up flamethrower like a Blake Bortles.
It's
a wind-up, but it can look very good. It can look horrendous at times. He throws some very inconsistent passes, but it can also look extremely good, and I try to find someone who can channel that. And that's what I do for 2017 if I'm Jacksonville. And I hire an offensive-minded head coach.
Number two.
So we're going to move on to topic two. And you know what I was thinking as I watched the Denver Broncos fall to the New England Patriots? And we'll break it down deeper. But I wonder if there's ever a scenario where the Broncos go back to Brock Osweiler.
Okay, is this like a bridge or a segue thing? Like, I have to admit, I didn't think that at all. I don't think Trevor Siemian's the problem.
You don't lie awake at night wondering if in 2019 Brock Osweiler might be the Broncos' starting quarterback?
Well, no, I do, but I mean, I didn't think this when I was watching the Patriots game. I don't think so. The problem with that Denver offense is very obvious, and people, this is front page headline type stuff, or this is a sidebar column, local sidebar column. They need to run the ball better. That's what everybody says when the offense doesn't go well. They got to run the ball better. In this case, it's actually true. They need to run the ball better because not only are they not having success throwing on first down, which we talked about in the look ahead show last week, and that continued a little bit in this game. They tried more first down passes. They didn't work very well, but their running concepts and passing concepts are not very married right now. They're supposed to be built off one another. They're supposed to all kind of look the same. It's a zone offense. You get in a rhythm, run pass, play action, moving pockets. You don't see that from Denver these days. It's like they're calling individual plays, all of them in a vacuum, and that is not how you can play, mainly with any offense in the NFL, but especially with one with a young QB like Trevor Siemian, who I think's playing okay, but no better than okay, and he's clearly a game manager, role player type guy, because they're not hanging points on the board without their run game doing anything.
Well, 10 carries, 37 yards for Justin Forsett, and 6 for 17 for Devontae Booker. I mean, is the issue the running backs? I'm sure it's a little bit of everything. Is the issue the running backs, or is it the issue what's happening up front? Because they were doing all right earlier in the year.
Yeah, it's a tough one to reconcile, because the offensive line did look much better early in the year, and it has not looked as good lately. I mean, they could not move the Patriots' defensive line in this game, and that's not the easiest defensive line to move. We never talk about Malcolm Brown and Branch at defensive tackle, or Trey Flowers, or new versatile piece up front, or Chris Long, but that's been a pretty solid unit for much of the season. So that came to the forefront today, but Denver's O-line hasn't been as good. We mentioned Andy Janovich has been out, so now they're not a two-back running team anymore. They're back to being a single-back running offense. different structure, different format of your run game, and they have not been as effective there. And I think those are the two big things. I think the Janovich injury, the more I think about it, that one hurt a lot more than what initially appeared on the surface. You think, oh, the fullback's out, he plays 25 snaps a game, we find a new guy. It has not gone that way. They haven't found a new guy. They don't do two back sets anymore. They do single back, and it's not working.
I guess this is what I wonder when we talk Andy Janovich. How difficult is it to find a fullback out there? Not many teams use them. There's a handful that go around every year. I mean, the Seahawks just added Marcel Reese. Not that Marcel Reese is a stalwart lead blocker, but, I mean, there's guys out there. John Connor. I mean, what's he doing these days?
I hear what you're saying, and I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question, and it is interesting because, like you mentioned, Marcel Reese, and I put on the Seahawks film the other day and thought, I don't know the last time I've seen a fullback join a team and kind of change the definition of the team in mid-December, because he can give them different stuff out of different formations. He'll split out. He's not a great lead blocker, but he did it effectively, and I don't remember the last time I saw that kind of thing happen. So my guess is the answer to your question, Gary, is it is difficult. It's more difficult than you'd think. And what Janovich did so well, I think he saw the field the same way those running backs saw the field. When you have a lead blocker, not many teams do lead blockers anymore, but when you have a lead blocker, then you need your fullback to read the field the same way as the running back, because that's how you set up the angles. That's how the running back follows you. That's where the chemistry is built. And it's hard to just plug in another guy who can do that. And then it's also hard to be plugging in running backs who can look at things the same way. There's no continuity now in the backfield. And I think if it were easy to find a new Andy Janovich, they would have done that by now.
Yeah. Well, on the other side of the ball in this game, it kind of played out exactly how everyone thought it would play out. Patriots couldn't really get it going through the air. They did enough on the ground. And as you watch this game, you just kind of said, you know, the only way the Broncos are going to get on the board here is if they get a turnover and a short field. And there was just no chance of that happening.
Yeah, interesting approach from the Patriots. It was a very controlled approach. It was either a between the tackles running game or a spread short area passing game. And, I mean, there wasn't a lot to it other than there were times where it was interesting to see who Denver was guarding with players, because Tlaib was on Bennett at times. Other times he was on the running back. Brady felt comfortable targeting Tlaib with his running backs through the air. So there was a little bit of a matchup element, but it wasn't your typical matchup stuff. But it wasn't a conventional game in that sense. But in the grander sense, it was a conventional Patriots game. If you just look at the formations and concepts they were employing, it was a very cautious approach, which this game, that was appropriate given how the other side of the ball was playing out. And they got a few mismatches here and there, and they sustained offense by running the ball. Denver played a lot of too high safety looks too, which I found a little bit unusual, because there were times where Devlin was on the field, the fullback. There's another fullback for you. A lot of fullback talk already. Devlin was on the field. They still played two high safeties back, and I don't quite understand why you would do that, especially when New England's such an underneath passing team. Mm-hmm. They're not a vertical passing team. And Gronkowski's not in there, so why are you guarding the seams so closely? But I'm not going to sit here and say Wade Phillips didn't have a reason for it. I'm sure he did. Yeah. I just found it interesting.
Yeah, well, this was Brady's first win in Denver since 2011. He had lost three straight there. And, you know, you look at the game last year, the AFC Championship game. They played him twice, but the AFC Championship game, you know, that Broncos offense didn't necessarily move the ball a ton. They got a couple of big plays in the red zone to Owen Daniels, and the Patriots kind of had to play from behind in that one. But, you know, this one sort of, the game script played out as the Patriots would have wanted it to play out.
Yep.
Number three.
All right, well, let's go on to topic three, and this was Dallas on Sunday night once again. The Bucks and Jameis Winston go down to Jerry World, and the Cowboys hang on in this one. Nice outing for Dak Prescott, and I think it put to rest any lingering quarterback controversy talk that we might have on future podcasts.
Yeah, because both of these quarterbacks, it felt like they had a very good sense of what they were looking at with the coverages throughout the night. And we talked last week with Prescott about how the Giants changed things up so much. Steve Spagnuolo, their defensive coordinator, he switches coverages from snap to snap. He changes his fronts. He rotates a ton of different guys into different personnel packages in different situations. There's almost no pattern to what he does. And you could see how slowly Prescott was seeming to process all of that stuff and how much slower he played. And I told you, Gary, I didn't think it'd be the same against Tampa. Tampa's defense is playing as well as the Giants' defense coming into this game, but they're doing it for different reasons, and they're not as multiple and not as wide-reaching. They're good at coverage rotations and disguises, but they're not extreme in how creative they get with it. And it was very apparent that Prescott had a much clearer sense for what he was seeing, and so it became a game of execution. And when it's an execution game, Prescott's often the better player because when he's calm, he's a very good cerebral executor.
Yep. Yeah, and, you know, Jameis found a nice rhythm in this game. And not to nitpick on one play call, like it was the difference in this game, but late in the first half, because he got to go in the third quarter, but late in the first half, that last drive they had and you know, they were tempo, he hit a couple of the seams, and they got down, they were at the, they were deep, it was a long first and goal, it was like first and goal from the 8, and, you know, they just sort of, they slowed down, and they went big, and they lost 5 yards on the run, and then, of course, it was followed by the rare, unnecessary roughness call on the quarterback for just a poorly feigned headbutt right there. He tried to make it look like it was an accident, and it just wasn't, it wasn't very well played. But yeah, I hated that slowdown. I hated that you know, when they sort of pulled up a little bit there.
Well, and I don't understand why you would try to like have an accidental headbutt. Like, isn't the point of headbutting someone to send a message of intimidation, to send any kind of message at all? And so to accidentally headbutt a guy and do it poorly, like you said, isn't very productive. I'll say this. It didn't strike me about what you're talking about going heavy there in that red zone situation. It did not strike me as odd at the time, but having watched all of Tampa's, almost all of their snaps on offense this year, that's something Dirk Koetter has done, and it's worked out okay for them in times. So whenever my flags go up, it's when teams depart from what they do, because a lot of, there are no bad concepts in football. They wouldn't exist for long if there were. So it's a matter of what concepts work for you, and going heavy is something the Bucs have felt has worked for them this year. They're not explosive out of it, but it keeps them on schedule, and Koetter, for whatever reason, decided that was a time to go heavy. But you're right, it put him in a negative yardage situation. Winston's mistake, there was the difference in that one, but on that particular play, I thought it was a great second half for Jameis Winston. What those first two drives of the second half, he's had about, Gary, he's had 4 or 5 games this year. The first week one was the biggest one, but there's been other games. The game against the Chiefs comes to mind, where the Charger game was another one, where he gets hot for about 2 or 3 series there and can look as good as any QB in the league for a quarter or a quarter and a half.
Yeah, early on in the Seahawks game. It was like that.
Yep, you're right. And when he gets in a rhythm, and it's kind of a timing offense. It's not a super timing-based offense, but it is a precision offense in Tampa, and they do things a little deeper, and there are route combinations. When he gets hot and starts hitting those deep intermediate throws, he's as gutsy as any player in the NFL, and he can be as dangerous as any player, too, because he's gutsy. He's willing to try. I don't know if there's a QB that takes bigger risks and takes them more often than Winston in the big scheme of things.
Yeah, well, so they got out there, they took the lead, and the fourth quarter was, I mean, give Rod Marinelli credit in that Cowboys defense, because this was a complete shutdown in the fourth quarter of an offense that came out and just went on two long TD drives to start the second half. They end up with, let's count this up, 10 total yards of offense in the fourth quarter. That is over 5 drives for the Bucs, that's not good.
Nope, it's not. And the key factor, and anyone who watched the game saw it, because NBC did a great job of highlighting it, it was Goster Chairless at right tackle, couldn't block David Irving.
Yeah.
And David
I gotta
Irving,
ask you about David Irving, because
yeah, who is he, and where did this come from?
Well, not only that, but you see him out there, and it's not like he's some dude who's like, oh, the 6'2", 260-pound guy or something like that. I mean, he looks, he's a first guy off the bus type of guy. I mean, he's 6'7", and he's he's got that sort of tapered build, and he looks like he can play, and he moves pretty well. He's just not out there much. He had 2 sacks tonight. He had 1.5 career over his 2 seasons coming into this game.
So after the championships, NFC and AFC championships, I'll go to Mobile, Alabama for the Senior Bowl, and I'll spend the entire week just running around meeting with coaches, meeting new coaches, seeing coaches I know, and I'll do the same thing at the Combine in Indianapolis. And as I watch all of these games during the season, I type out questions I want to ask those guys. Off the record, just football learning stuff. And one of the questions I typed tonight, and I can't wait to ask it tonight, in Dallas, they have some excellent coaches there. Great conversation, guys that can teach the game to someone like me. I'm going to ask them, what would happen if David Irving played 50 snaps a game? Because there's got to be a reason for that. He's obviously talented. He does this a lot. This was not an aberrational performance. It was an extreme one, but he's been this kind of a player, this splash player, for about 2 years now, and yet he doesn't play more snaps. So I wonder what the reason is, and I'm going to be very interested to hear what it is, because it probably speaks to greater football philosophy. Why don't the Cowboys play him more? And I don't know. We'll see. We'll find out. I don't know if I'll be able to tell you, but I'll beat around the bush and we'll get the
answer.
There
you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, Benson Mayawa, who was he was Albert Breer guy. You can, of course, hear Albert Breer's podcast on Tuesdays. But Breer had made a couple mentions of him during the preseason, saying he was a guy to keep an eye on. He made a little impact tonight as well, as he has all year.
He's been a high-energy player for a number of years. I remember him in Seattle, and I think Oakland was his other stop. He jumps off the film as well, more for effort and energy, though. Irving has that as well, but Irving has a talent factor to go in with it. Mayo was a nice player.
Nice, nice. Well, solid win for the Cowboys here. They get back on track and certainly silence any panic that was going down about the direction of their team heading towards the postseason. Before we jump on to topic 4, just a reminder for anyone who does not realize it, we do 2 shows a week now. We do a Thursday look-ahead show where we preview the upcoming week's games. We also take a giant portion of our mailbag. No, it's the entire mailbag. It's just a really big mailbag. We don't do it on the show anymore. So tune in on Thursday. If you subscribe, it will be in your feed Thursday afternoon. And, of course, if you subscribe on iTunes, please leave a review. That helps other people find the show. And that's what we're going for. And it helps, gives Annie and I a nice ego boost, which is really, that's what we're after too.
Absolutely.
This is the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out Open Floor with Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver.
I'm pretty embarrassed. I've never been to Oracle. That is something I need to do before they move.
Yeah, I mean, it is a spectacular dump of an arena for an amazing team.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of Open Floor wherever you download your shows.
Number 4.
Packers win a cold one and an exciting one over the Bears. This one, every time it looked like they were going to pull away and leave Chicago in their wake, Bears just hung around.
Matt Barkley's playing well for them, and we don't need to have the discussion of what that means for next year, but let's just put that out there right now. I've enjoyed watching him, and something he's done. In this game, he came from behind again, not quite enough, but came from behind against a defense that was not just playing soft zone coverage to let the clock run. Green Bay was changing it up. They were bringing pressure, and noteworthy there is that's the same thing Tennessee did a few weeks ago when the Bears came from behind, and that one also came up just a little bit short in the end. But Barkley has faced critical moments now, or he's created critical moments by making close games of it again in the fourth quarter, and he's doing it against aggressive, multifaceted defenses. I like him.
No, I mean, look, he was – Lane Kiffin owes him. Lane Kiffin destroyed his arm at USC. He had that, had the shoulder injury from getting just hammered on a bad USC team, a talented USC team, but a bad USC team because they were not particularly well coached. And, you know, that sort of robbed them of the arm strength. And once the arm strength was gone, obviously, you know, you can only do so much in the NFL. And that's why he's never really gotten any sort of serious consideration as more than sort of a, you know, number three emergency type of guy. But he is, you know, he got his opportunity and he is taking advantage of it, which is nice to see. What is also nice to see is Jordy Nelson seems to look a lot like the old Jordy Nelson over the last month or so, let's say.
He's getting there, and he had three deep balls to him today. He didn't catch the first two. I'm not going to call them drops, but he probably would say he thought he should have caught them. He caught the last one, though. And that play by Aaron Rodgers, that 60-yard completion on 3rd and 11 to Nelson, that transcends any analysis. That's just an unbelievable throw, and we've seen Rodgers do that a number of times at the end of games. This was another game where he was getting sacked late in the down, and as our listeners always know, I always tell you got to see the film to know what that means, because Rodgers leaves guys open, and we don't know why, and also guys flat out don't get open at times, and sometimes we don't know why there. It's a baffling offense in Green Bay. It once again was that today. No rhythm, no flow, but the quarterback made a few remarkable plays and none bigger than the last one, and that was enough.
I was going to say, I feel like we talk about the Packers offense less, and I wasn't sure if that's because we just are, you know, we've talked about it as much as it could possibly be talked about. We've filled the metaphorical glass that is discussion about the Green Bay Packers offense, or if they were doing a little bit better. I like what I've seen from Jordy Nelson the last couple weeks, but that's about it. That's all I can say about it.
Well, there's one other dimension we haven't talked about a whole lot, and that's Ty Montgomery. And we know what he does for their passing game, because he gives them a flat route option out of the backfield, which is big for them. When you run a lot of slant patterns like Green Bay does, you often complement those with someone running a pattern to the flat, and that's how you isolate zone defenders. And so if you have two receivers doing that, two wide receivers, that's critical. But Montgomery, Gary, he's becoming less and less of a receiver and more of a true ball carrier, and this was a sensational performance. People see the bottom line of him, and I think it was something like 16 carries for 162 yards around there, and I think he had a couple of touchdowns. They probably think, oh, he had a few big runs. It wasn't that. These were sustainable carries. He was breaking tackles. Yeah. He's very patient in traffic. He has a sense for setting up his blocks. His two touchdowns both came around the 5-yard line, so not powerhouse football in the tight red zone, which he can't do, but still condensed football where you have to be a running back and you have to get in space and beat defenders in confined areas and all those different dimensions. He's looking like a pro running back now.
Yeah. And look, this was a big one for the Packers, because all they have to do now is win out. They beat the Vikings at home, and then if they win at Detroit week 17, they are NFC North champions no matter what Detroit does next week. And Detroit has to go to Dallas anyway, so you figure you might have a little leeway there anyway for the Packers if the Lions do indeed lose to the Cowboys on the road. But this was nice. This is a little more interesting than it probably should have been, but this was a nice win for the Packers nonetheless.
Number 5.
Let's jump ahead to topic 5, and this was one of the games we talked about in last week's Look Ahead show. It was not the big name marquee franchise matchup here, but the Titans win one of the best games of the day, one of the best games of the season, over the Chiefs. And this was, again, and like in Green Bay, this was a freezing cold game, and this was one where it looked like it was going to get away from the Titans early, and they come back and they pull it out in the end. I guess what I'd say to you, Andy, is this was a game where it looked like it was, you know, Titans wanted to run the ball. They weren't going to be able to run the ball because they fell behind by 2 touchdowns early. Marcus Mariota did not play particularly well for most of this game. The defense again, you know, and it was a defense facing a well-designed offense, and they held up.
Yeah, they did hold up. Part of me wonders what to make of it. Their defense, where the issues were, we talked about this game, going into the look ahead as well. Their issues are at cornerback, and Kansas City's really not a team equipped to exploit your cornerbacks.
Yeah.
Where they beat you is in the middle of the field and with matchup problems and through play design, which often means you're beating your linebackers or your safeties. And the Titans are very good at those positions. They have linebackers who can run and play in space, and they have versatility and depth at the safety position. So they match up well to Kansas City, and you wonder how big of a factor that is. But Gary, anytime you come back, and they were on the road in this one, so they were in Kansas City. Anytime you come back in Kansas City in a game where you didn't play your style of football, where you couldn't establish the run and control the tempo and all those things, that's a positive. When you win games that you should lose, that's a huge positive in the NFL.
Yeah. And of course, the debate would have been had they lost this game. Malarkey opted to go for two with 3:12 left. They had one timeout in their pocket. They had scored to close the lead to 17-16. Malarkey went for two. Didn't get it. Do you like the decision, Andy?
Well, you always have to contextualize those, and we don't know what they practiced this week. And as we always say, he had a play he liked. I hope he had a play he liked. He wasn't just going for two for the sake of it. Didn't work out. He wasn't the only one that had that issue on this Sunday. So, you know, I don't second-guess that kind of thing. If it works, he's a genius. If he doesn't, then he's a genius for finding a way to get a field goal late, I guess, huh?
It looked like I thought there were two very well-defended key plays. That two-point conversion, the Titans, it looked like they won a little pick on the goal line there, and the Chiefs switched it up, and they defended it beautifully, and that's how that play got busted up. And then the Chiefs had a 3rd and 3 when they could have, you know, it was one of those situations where if they got the first down, game would have been over. And they ran a little option with Alex Smith, and Titans defended it perfectly. And that's how they got the ball back. And then Mariota made a couple of big throws when he had to. And Ryan Succop, of course, gets the second attempt. Misses the first one short, but Andy Reid had called the timeout. So Succop comes out and hits the 53-yarder to win it. And
Peter
King.
Seems like that happens. Doesn't that seem like it happens a lot? The icing, they ice and they wait too long, and so they give the guy a warm-up, and then he hits the second one, or the other way around. But the whole icing the kicker thing, it doesn't often go the way the coach who's calling the timeout anticipates it going.
I can't remember many instances where it worked out correctly, where someone made it on the iced attempt and then came back out and missed it. I'm sure it's happened. I just don't remember it off the top of my head. I mean, most of the time they make them both, so it's a moot point. But this was, and whatever, we don't need to second guess whether or not to use the ice timeout. I don't have a strong opinion about it, but I will share my opinion on this. I just thought because of the weather, and you got a guy who was on the sideline for so long because he hadn't kicked the extra point on the previous play, I think I'd rather just make him go out there and try and try and get the 53-yard kick, which is going to take all your leg. Just make him try and... I mean, obviously he's been warming up, but make him try and get that on the first one.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the other thing you could say, though, is he can't use his warm gear. He can't wear the parka or be near the heaters like you are in the sideline. So make him stand out there in the cold for a little longer. But I don't know. And Andy Reid doesn't know either, by the way. We're not we're not scientists. And I don't know if scientists would know this kind of stuff.
I was going to say, I don't who know what kind
this?
Of scientists
who does know,
know
this kind
that?
Of thing? Yeah, well, who has the answer to this?
Climatologist. Is that even a thing? I think I just made up a new job. But yeah, Ryan Succop talked to Peter King and said getting that first attempt out allowed him he didn't realize how much leg he needed in the cold to get it there.
Oh, ouch. Oh.
So that's what Succop basically said. I mean, it wasn't like a taunt, but he just said, you know, that's what happened. He didn't realize he was short on the first one. He didn't realize how much he had to put behind it.
By the way, I'm claiming him because we've talked about him so long and we're in the middle of the show. I'm claiming him for my special teams guy, so now we don't have to do that segment at the end where we name our special teams player of the week. Yeah.
Number 6.
Well, that's not until topic 9, and right now we are on to topic 6, and this is the Oakland Raiders clinched their playoff berth. Nice win for the Raiders. Not a beautiful win today. A little bit ugly, a little bit turnover prone, but they go down to San Diego and get the win, and the Oakland Raiders are in the playoffs for the first time since they lost that Super Bowl to the Bucks back in, that was the 02 season. That was the Super Bowl played in 03, the John Gruden Bowl. But yeah, this was, you know, a game that maybe in previous years the Raiders don't win this kind of game. They needed to come back in it. They just sort of hung around and you know, they had the Chargers make a couple of mistakes, and that's how they got back in it.
Yeah, there's some, again, it goes back to what we said about the Titans just a second ago. There's something to be said for winning games that you don't play well or you shouldn't have won, and that was something the Raiders didn't do for a long time. So congratulations to them. I think how they perform in the postseason, I feel like I'm just going to hedge both sides. I think it comes down to Derek Carr and how their defense plays. In other words, a passing game. Do they win in the air or do they lose in the air? And I think that will ultimately determine their playoff fate.
Yeah. Well, they hung around. The defense certainly contained the Chargers in the second half of this game, didn't let it get away. And then a couple Janikowski field goals, and that's your game. That's,
you know, Gary, I didn't see this one very much. This one, did San Diego get any big plays against them? I know in their first matchup earlier this year, the Chargers beat them deep several times, and there were a few where Rivers mis-executed on the throw, and so it actually worked in Oakland's favor. But conceptually or tactically, the Chargers beat Oakland deep badly. Did Oakland get that corrected in this game?
Well, Travis Benjamin got him early, and that was kind of it. There were a lot of crossers. And I think the Raiders picked up on that as the game went on. Dontrell Inman did a little bit of damage, but you know, there was nothing huge downfield after that early Travis Benjamin catch.
Okay, so that's a positive that you don't get beat the same way a second time, or you correct that thing. And crossing routes, San Diego, they're the best crossing route team in the NFL. So that doesn't surprise me. That's what you have to defend that if you're going to play against them. And you mentioned Inman. Inman's also, I think you said it before I noticed it several weeks ago. He is a sensational route runner.
Yeah, I really thought he was the guy who was going to sort of take over once Keenan Allen got going.
Yeah.
Sorry, I shouldn't say got going, got gone.
Yeah.
He got out for the season. I thought he was going to be Rivers' guy.
And it hasn't quite turned out that way, but I think if you asked Rivers, who do you trust most, it's third down and 12 and. Let's say it's third and 15, so that makes it a little harder to identify Antonio Gates. I think Inman's the guy Rivers would trust most as his downfield weapon. I know Williams is most dangerous, but Inman's a highly reliable receiver because of how precise he is as a route runner.
Yeah.
Number seven.
Well, Andy, let's go on to topic number seven, and that is the Giants winning as the Giants do now. This is a defense first type of game with the Lions in East Rutherford. I mean, I don't know what else you can say about this defense at this point. They shut down what was an inferior group of weapons, and yeah, this was a game where the Giants just sort of held on to a touchdown lead for a very long time, stretched it out at the end, and that was all it took.
I hope Janoris Jenkins is okay in the bigger picture for this. And I hope he can play, if not next week, then in the near future. He left this game, got banged up, and you hope that for him personally, but just I like to see this defense with all its pieces, because what makes it special is that not only are they great at three corner spots, and I think they're great at all three spots now, or at least on the cusp of greatness, but how many teams can you say where they're just not even weak at one of them? Because if you're weak at a corner spot, then at least that's the answer. That's how you go after that defense. That's what you build your plays around. With the Giants, there's no obvious answer for how to attack them through the air because of who they have at cornerback. And if Jenkins is out, they might be able to survive that. Rogers Cromartie's obviously played a lot on the perimeter before. Eli Apple's playing well. And they've got guys, Sensabaugh and Wade are experienced in the slot. But Sensabaugh and Wade, that's the answer. That's who you're going after, and now there's a way to attack this Giants defense.
Yeah, this was it looked like a back injury when it happened on the field. Mike Florio reported afterwards that the Giants were worried about internal organs for Janoris Jenkins, and that's something to be worried about. That's not a good injury to have. So we'll have to see what goes down. It sounded more like precautionary. I don't know if this was a case of Florio sort of doing the Florio alarmist thing, but
yeah,
let's hope it was. Let's hope he's all right.
Yeah. Well, and fortunately, there are no legal ramifications here. So the Florio alarmist bells could only ring so loud and so far because there's no legal elements to break down in 10 paragraphs, which Florio does very well. But he likes to do it.
He does. Lawyers like to lawyer.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Yeah, this was – and Matthew Stafford, he looked – the finger looked fine. The ball seemed to come out fine all game. This just really looked like a game where his receivers were not nearly as good as the guys covering them, and I think that's how this one broke out for the Lions. They got down to the they had to settle for field goals a couple times, and we can talk about fumble luck on this one, because for a long time the difference in this game was Zach Zenner ran for a first down, got inside the five, fumbled, and the Giants recovered in the end zone. And then on the other end, Vereen caught a little dump off pass, ran for a first down, got inside the five, fumbled, and Victor Cruz pounced on top of it in the end zone. And that's that was 7 points on one side, and it was a lost turnover on the other. And this game was 10-3 for a very long time.
Yeah, and the guys at Football Outsiders, I'm not a big numbers guy, but I think Aaron Schatz and those guys have some interesting elements to what they do. I think they're smart. They have studied fumbles over the years, and basically fumbling is a 50-50 proposition, and there's no pattern to it. And so you said fumble luck. I normally roll my eyes when the word luck gets tossed into football conversations, but that's what fumbles are a lot of time.
Yeah, and these were truly, I mean, this wasn't a guy ripping it out and sort of having it go right into his chest. These were things that rolled 5 yards and a pileup, and someone ends up on the bottom with the ball. So,
yeah.
Nice win for the Giants here. They're actually still in the hunt for that NFC East title. I mean, you'd presume they will not get it. Cowboys only need one more win to clinch, but nice win here for the Giants.
They're a team you're not going to want to play in the postseason. All of them are. I mean, if you're in the playoffs, you can win a game. But
you're not going to get the Browns in the playoffs.
Right. But the Giants are – they're not an easy team to play against because they're finding their identity more and more each week. We're talking about their defense mainly. And
yeah.
That's a scary defense to go up against. They know who they are, and they have the guys to execute who they want to be.
And even, no Jason Pierre-Paul. And the last 2 weeks, they've had two great games against good offenses.
Number eight.
All right, topic number eight. And this was down in Arizona. This one was, if you're a fantasy football player, you enjoyed this game. This was a game with very little defense, which is surprising when you're talking about the Saints' defense, but I should say not surprising, but certainly surprising when you're talking about this Cardinals' defense. And the final is 48-41, so hopefully you bet the over in this one. And I guess the storyline after the game, Cardinals are out of it, officially mathematically eliminated from postseason. What's the word? How did I forget that word? Postseason consideration. Competition.
All right. Postseason. Yeah, contention, I think, is the word you're looking
contention,
for.
Contention. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm under the weather. I have a cold, and it's also affecting my vocabulary.
Yep.
Carson Palmer says he will be back in 2017. Larry Fitzgerald, they're saying it was non-committal. I think he's taking the... I think he's just leaving the door open a crack in case the season ends and it gets into the offseason and he decides, this really isn't what I want to go through again. But I don't know. What do you make of Palmer at this point in his career?
Bring him back. He was too good last season. If you have this happen again next year, it was worth the risk. His offensive line has been deplorable this season.
Yeah.
And they ask a lot of that offensive line in that scheme. It's a deeper drop-back type scheme. It's not like what they do in Indianapolis, but they do a lot of empty formations, and they throw at the deep and intermediate levels. So it's an aggressive approach, and guys have to win one-on-one and pass protection, and they haven't done that. So they need to recalibrate there. Some of it's just getting guys healthy. I mean, Humphreys has been out lately. Valdir's been out for a few weeks now. They need to upgrade at right guard. Warford hasn't played well. You bank on him being better than he was this season. But if the offensive line's fixed and that offense has a chance to be what it was again, Palmer has not played well either. But so much of it has started up front. The protection's been bad, and Palmer has responded poorly to that. I would bring him back and Bay. What's your other choice? I mean, you're a veteran team. You're built to win now. They love him there. They feel that he runs the show and is the absolute unequivocal leader of that team.
Yeah.
Where's your better option in there then?
Trade for Osweiler.
No, you take Palmer, and he's not washed up. I don't watch him and get the sense he's washed up. I watch him and get the sense that he's a quarterback who was never comfortable this season for a variety of reasons. And I go back, I think, again, it starts with who he has blocking for him.
All right. Well, the highlight of this one for the Cardinals was Kerwin Williams with the 49-yard touchdown run with one shoe missing. That was neat.
Oh.
And he ended up their leading rusher today. I mean, it feels like that should be the answer to a really bad, minute trivia question get right.
No, I have, who was the last guy to do that? Because I have the answer to it. I was going to say until you brought up trivia. Now I'm asking you.
To lead the Cardinals in rushing, that is not David Johnson?
No, to run a touchdown with one shoe.
To run a touchdown with one shoe? It was old Ira One Shoe Rabinsky.
Feel free to tweet me if I'm wrong. Maybe I've forgotten the shoe thing. I know it's not a stat that you can click on at NFL.com. But I believe it was Barry Sanders, because I specifically remember him having one. His sock was floppy. That's what I remember. Not only did he not have a shoe on, but somehow, through all that athleticism and all those precisions and cuts and body control that made him so amazing, he was a guy that had floppy socks. His socks weren't pulled up tight.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
All right. Well, Kerwin Williams, maybe he was paying homage to Barry Sanders with this TD run that opened the scoring today in this.
Was it a read option look out of, I didn't see that run either. Was it a read option look out of Wildcat?
Yeah, I only saw the back end of the run because he was missing the shoe.
I got you. The reason I ask is I watched Cardinals film. I actually watched it this morning before I watched all these other games live. And I can't tell. They ran read option with him against Miami 3 times last week. And the first one, I was sure it wasn't actually a read option. It was just they unblocked the defender in the end, but he was keeping it all the way. And then when they did it again and again, I started to question that. He does not read the unblocked defender very long. And I wonder if he's just a ball hog, if that's how he's playing, if he's deciding on his own that he's doing that, or if they tell him not to. And that's another question I'll ask a coach. Bruce Arians answers that stuff. When you see him in Mobile,
yeah,
you ask him something like that, hey, was Kerwin Williams really reading the defensive end? And he'll say yes or no and nothing more. It's just, let's give you the answer and leave you there with the silence to fill it yourself. You go, oh, gee, all right, good. Well, thanks, coach. Yeah, that's got you there. He just gets right to the point. So that's a question I'll ask him when I see him in Mobile. It sounds like he'll be there now because they're not going to be in the playoffs.
There you go. And you were correct. It was a read option play. It was the Wildcat, and it was the fake to David Johnson. He pulled it back and went around right end. Lost his shoe in the process.
All right.
But this was also, they went back and forth, and the game was tied. Cardinals special teams again. Justin Bethel lines up in the neutral zone on a field goal. That gives new life to a Saints drive. That ends up in a fourth quarter touchdown, and then they had I don't mind the blow to the head stuff, like the sort of weak blow to the head stuff on quarterbacks when it's like you're swatting at a pass and you catch them in the head and they flag you. A rule's a rule, but boy, there was a play at the end. It was getting real interesting because it was an all-out blitz. They beat the Saints, fooled Breeze. He had to tuck it in and basically ducked and just ended up under a pile. And they threw a flag for a blow to the head during the sack. I don't see how you can call it when a guy basically tucks the ball in and ducks and goes down. I mean, someone's going to contact his head at some point.
Well, and I don't mean to be like I don't mean to be the analyst again here, but I wonder if it's that they fooled Breeze or they fooled the receiver that Breeze was looking to throw hot to, because
yeah,
the Cardinals go all out blitz at the end of close games more than any team in the NFL. That's what James Betcher does, and he does it because that's what Bruce Arians wants. And they've done it last year. They had several big plays with it. Tony Jefferson, I remember, had several big plays out of it, and they've done it the last several weeks. So for Drew Breeze to be caught by surprise by an all out blitz at the end of the game, to me, would be shocking. It sounds like they got the benefit, though. They got lucky there. Somebody tapped him on the head.
Yeah, it was a pretty brutal call. And it did. It was going to make it really interesting because they were up 7 at the time, and there was about 4 minutes left. and they were going to have to kick about a 52-yard field goal if there was no flag on it. But there was a flag, and they scored a touchdown a couple plays later, and that was about all in this one.
Number nine.
All right, topic number nine, the lightning-ish round. We're ready for it. Well, I'm ready for it. You ready for it, Andy?
I can be ready. I'm ready.
All right. Well, I'm going to start, and I'm going to say right now, I'm going to give you no choice in a Thursday show. When we record our Thursday show, we are leading with Rex Ryan talk.
Okay. It's just, well, do you think he'll be fired? Do you think he'll be fired then? Is that what you're saying?
No, but honestly, I'm not sure he's going to be fired at all. Because time someone reports it, they sort of back off and they say, well, source says they're preparing to fire him. So he's not out yet, but they're getting ready if they decide they want to. And like that, come on.
All right. Well, so if that's the case, we want to save that talk. And this is our teaser now for Thursday, so you can read the promo again if you want or something. Cleveland, Buffalo.
I won't read the promo again. But I'll jump into the lightning round because the Bills knocked off the Browns sort of unsurprisingly up in Orchard Park, and it was a pretty easy win. LeSean McCoy ran wild in this one, but yeah, my favorite part of this was Joe Thomas after the game delivered the quote: "If you're not going to give a coach 4 years, don't hire him in the first place."
That's a great quote, absolutely great quote.
But we will dive deep into that Thursday. I'm so upset about it, I can't even talk. We will dive deep into it on Thursday on the Look Ahead Show. But, yeah, Andy, what do you want to talk about here?
Well, I want to go to Philadelphia and Baltimore because we've talked all year long about Baltimore and why don't they run the ball. They need to run the ball. Let's run the ball. They got up late in the fourth quarter in the red zone, and it's first down and 10. And John Harbaugh has now called this the worst play call, I think, of the season, something like that. It's a bad one. He's taking the blame. It was Marty Morningwick's play call. Harbaugh did not overwrite it, but they called a pass, and it was intercepted in the end zone. And Philadelphia wound up coming back from that. Isn't it ironic? And Philly didn't come all the way back, of course. But isn't it ironic or fitting, I guess I'd say, that Baltimore is now lamenting their own lack of ball carrying or their own addiction to throwing the football?
I know. And this high wins in this game, and I think that's why neither team really plan on throwing him much. The Eagles end up throwing around a little bit because they were trailing. But yeah, and this was another game where Eagles went for two at the end. And then out in Cincinnati, this was my
upset pick of the week.
It looked like it was going to come through. I was getting congratulatory tweets at halftime in this game, and I accepted them all. And yeah, the Bengals just stopped moving the ball after a little while, and the Steelers kicked field goal after field goal after field goal. This was the Chris Boswell show. He ended up kicking five of them, and then at the end, the Steelers punch it in for the touchdown and get the 24-20 win in Cincinnati.
Yeah, so you got this right until the very end of the game, I guess, is what we're going for, and that was out of that bold prediction. It was so gutsy of you to walk out and make a bold prediction in the part of the show called Bold Predictions.
I knew it was the time to do it.
Yeah.
And by the way, six field goals for Chris Boswell.
The Steelers are, the more I think about them, the more I think their running game is going to define this offense in the postseason. We've waited for the passing attack to blossom this year or be what it was early in the season. We waited for Sammy Coates to be healthy. Marcus Wheaton wound up being out. It looks like he's done. And I don't know if it's going to come to fruition. I think their passing attack, we're nearing Christmas, so their passing attack is what it is at this point. And if that's the case, then this is a team built on field goals. It is a team built on winning with the defense that looks to be getting better because they're kind of a running team now, and they can do a lot with inside zone and counter runs, and it's on Le'Veon Bell, and it's on David DeCastro. Those guys become, next to Roethlisberger, because he's still the QB, those guys become their most important players for the postseason. Either side of the ball.
I was talking about the home road splits for Roethlisberger, and I wonder if getting back home will sort of get this passing game back on track. But
did you watch any of the Colts and Vikings?
Yeah, I mean, it got out of hand pretty quickly. I mean, yeah, we were wondering if the Colts would move the ball at all on this Vikings defense, and the answer, Andy, was yes. Yes, they will.
We've said a few times on this show, and I think it's a point that's worth making every week. In the NFL, you can get away with having weaknesses or iffy players, you just can't have those weaknesses all concentrated at the same position. And that's what's happened to the Vikings this year, that they had the issues that the losing the quarterback did not fail them, and losing the best running back in football did not fail them. But losing an average left tackle and an average right tackle early in the season, that failed them, because now they had two really bad offensive tackles. And when you have a reactionary position like that, like a cornerback where you have to react to someone, or tackle where you're reacting to the pass rusher, you cannot afford to be weak in one area if it's a reactionary position. And that's all it took to do the Vikings in. I know that wasn't the deciding factor in this game, but they're to the point now where we're talking about them in the obituary terms, big picture for them. And that's what happened to them this season. And that's why they are in the position that they're in now.
And by the way, Adrian Peterson was back in this game, 6 for 22 and lost a fumble. So that was not, he was not the return. He basically had one decent run and that was about it.
Yeah. It's a lost year for him, and will be interesting to see what comes of him now, because he's getting older, and now he's had this lost season, and he's got a big contract next year too. So that maybe all of this stuff gets trumped by the business side of it. But I'll be curious to see what all Adrian Peterson has left. He hasn't shown signs of slowing down before getting hurt, but now does getting hurt mean he's slowing down? And only time will tell, I suppose.
Yeah, I believe it's a team option on his deal for next year. And finally, only game we haven't discussed so far was the Falcons destroying the 49ers in Atlanta, once again without Julio Jones. Though, you know, if you're going to miss Julio Jones for a couple of games, I guess these were the correct two games to be missing him in.
Yeah, absolutely. To be getting victories with your most valuable player gone, I think he is your most valuable player, that's a real plus. I mean, that's a huge plus. And whether it comes against the Niners or not, that's to get NFL wins like that at this stage of the season, is Dan Quinn and his staff ought to be very proud.
Yeah. I mean, they ran up 550 yards of offense today without Julio. They outscored opponents 83-27 the last 2 weeks without Julio Jones.
So maybe that's... Julio's been the problem all along. We just haven't known it.
Get him out of there. No, it helps when you're playing the Rams and the 49ers and they're a little bit mistake prone. But that's okay.
Number 10.
Andy, we are ready for topic 10. The awards. What everyone plays for every Sunday. The 10 Things Podcast Awards. Offensive Player of the Week. Do you want to go first?
I'll go simple and go Dak Prescott. Just out of, I mean, his completion percentage is just so high. And to bounce back when, I don't know if he felt the pressure or not, but in theory, pressure's on. This was a real statement game, all those kind of cliches. He answered them. The bottom line was he completed pretty much everything he threw. That's what matters.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give it to Ty Montgomery, and I will say this. He's got to get a new uniform number. He's got to get something in the – he's got to wear 48 or – no, Joe Thomas has that 28? They don't have a 28, do they?
I think, is that James Starks? I know it when I see it. I don't know. It's, but this is the second time in a row we've talked uniform numbers, but I find myself agreeing with you. It's a real advantage. I'll tell you what, to have a running back wearing number 88, that might seem small, but that's a real advantage, because when we're fans watching football, we look out there and go, oh, that's Ty Montgomery. We know that. A lot of these players on the NFL, they don't follow football like fans. They don't see it. And so they're used to reading uniform numbers. That's the point of the uniform number. And they don't know who Ty Montgomery is. In fact, a lot of times teams don't know the names of the guy. They just know the player. That's hey, we got to stop 88. We got to stop 21, whatever it is. So to have the guy at running back number 88, that's a real advantage for him, which is why I would imagine the NFL will tell him you have to move his number next year.
Yeah. No, it's pretty Josh Hawkins wears 28, so he's going to I will let him know he's got to give up that number. He's got to give it to Ty.
Who do you got? Oh, I'm sorry. In that case, and I probably need to just clarify, James Starks is number 44. And
44.
how I thought 28 on that, I'll never know.
It's that kind of show this week, Andy.
You know, I don't know guys' numbers, but when I see the number, I always know the guy.
Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. I knew you were wrong with 29, but or 28, but I couldn't tell you who it was. So I
right, I did too. And if you'd asked me, hey, who's 44 on the Packers? If you'd said it that way, I probably would have known James Starks. I don't know why that is. That's defensive player of the week. I guess I get to claim David Irving, right? Someone has to claim David Irving.
Yeah. No, I get. You know, I watch Texans and Jaguars depressingly closely, and I'm actually going to give it to Jadeveon Clowney, who was so good during this game. The Jaguars' entire offense for like the last three quarters of this game was just run it away from Jadeveon Clowney. Do everything away from Jadeveon Clowney. And even if you just go directly to the sideline and it's a 0 yard gain, that's fine as long as you don't go near him.
He's had a really, really, really nice season for them. He's becoming what they thought he would be. And isn't it interesting? We don't hear about J.J. Watt a whole lot, do we? I'm not saying we forgot about him, but if someone had told you at the beginning of the year J.J. Watt's going to be out for the season, that's something I think you would have guessed we'd be coming back to every week. It's, oh, Houston, oh, they're missing J.J. Watt, though. They're missing Watt. No one's saying anything. You move on in the NFL, yeah. And Clowney's a big part of their moving on process because, once again, they have one of the three or four best interior edge defensive linemen in the NFL.
Well, one, J.J. Watt's on a couple commercials. So when we do the commercials podcast, we'll talk about J.J. Watt. But two, I mean, the Texans have benched their starting quarterback, their big-money free agent starting quarterback, and lost probably the best non-quarterback in football. And they're still, you know, they're still in position to win the AFC South here. And
that's
I don't know
point.
If I'm, you know, I don't know if I want to bust on Bill O'Brien for the Osweiler investment, or I want to just sort of be in awe of what he's accomplishing without those two guys.
I'm going to choose to be in awe just to get the coach of the week thing out of the way, and I'm going to give it to Bill O'Brien. And then I guess tying things up, I already did my special teams guy earlier, Ryan Succop.
So now I'm done with my awards.
I know, but now I'm done with my awards. I got them turned in early.
All right. My special teams player of the week is actually Nick Novak from that same game that I loved so much. He hurt his leg. It looked like some sort of hammy or maybe something in the knee, and he was just sort of limping around. It looked like he wasn't going to be able to kick. Maybe it was just good theater. I don't know. Maybe he's just sort of into the drama. But, yeah, he ended up hitting 45, 43, 27, and then, of course, the game-winning extra point in the second half while he was limping around. He also delivered a terrible kickoff, but we'll give him a break for that because he was hurt. And my coach of the week, I'm going to give it to Rex Ryan, and we will talk about why on Thursday. We won't actually talk about why he beat the Browns this week, but we'll talk about it's absurd that we're talking about his job security right now.
I look forward to that conversation. I was hoping you'd want to do it, in fact, and that will be a good one. And then on Thursday, we'll break down three, or I'm going to try to talk into doing four games at some point, Gary, but we're going to break down some games for week 16.
We can
do
it.
I look forward to the Thursday show, yeah. Well, we have to get in playoff form. In playoffs, they're going to be four games those first 2 weeks of the playoffs, so we might as well.
We only do three. We just decide one game. It's just
one of the playoff
games.
Yeah. Well, good.
Andy, that's our show. We will be back Thursday. In the meantime, we want to thank our producer, Matt Havia, and our editor, Chris Basil. Also, our researcher, Jeff Irwin. He makes us sound smart, even when we don't sound so smart, like today, when we sort of stumbled through everything. And thank you most of all to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Send in those questions for the mailbag that we do on Thursday. We will make it as big as we possibly can. Every week, you can tweet Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. We're on Facebook. If you ask a question on Facebook, you can make it like as long as you want to. Those are always nice. Or if you're, if you're sort of an old man, send it to talkback@themmqb.com. Put podcast in the email subject, and we will hopefully see it. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, he has Jerry Jones this week, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Thursday.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.